is a strange and bitter crop.
Billie Holiday and Strange Fruit. It's a remarkable song, and the story of that song has been told in a book called Strange Fruit, the biography of a song by David Margalik, who is our very special guest this morning. David, good morning.
Good morning.
Around the time that Strange Fruit was written, how prevalent were lynchings still in the South?
Well, the number of lynchings in the South had actually gone down considerably by the time Strange Fruit was written. I think that they actually peaked in the 1880s or 1890s, around the turn of the century. But they were still happening, and they were still incredibly shocking whenever they did happen. And they were still on the front pages of the radical press, and they were still very much a subject of popular campaigning. There were attempts throughout these years to pass anti-lynching legislation in the United States Congress that Southern congressmen continually thwarted. So it remained very much an issue in American politics and American culture, even though the raw number of lynchings had actually declined significantly.
How many are we talking about? Say, in the 1930s, do we know how many lynchings occurred and where they were taking place?
I think the numbers were under 100 a year, but I'm not really sure. They were taking place almost exclusively in the South, and they were almost exclusively of black people.
And there was a particular photo that inspired the original poem, which I think was called Bitter Fruit. Just explain how that came about.
Well, the man who wrote Strange Fruit, originally Bitter Fruit, was a New York school teacher named Abel Meeropol. Abel Meeropol was a communist, was a left-wing radical who read the radical press. And on somewhere in the radical press, a photograph appeared of the latest lynching. And he was someone who wrote poetry for all occasions. I mean, he was constantly moved to write songs and poems. And he saw this photograph, and he was outraged by it. And he sat down and wrote a poem about it.
And where was that poem published?
It was originally published in the magazine or the newsletter of the New York School Teachers Union.
Mm-hmm.
And originally it was just a poem. It was not set to music. He did that a little while later.
And it's not unusual at that time or even later that perhaps Jewish school teachers are going to be radicals and possibly communists. Was he a communist?
He was a communist. I mean, the left-wing circles in the United States, and particularly in New York, were heavily Jewish.
Yeah.
This was before Jews were purged and radicals were purged from the New York City school system, which didn't happen until the 40s and 1950s. And, you know, the radicalism was very popular in New York, left-wing radicalism in the 1930s. It was a time of great turbulence in the country, and it wasn't unusual. It really wasn't unusual for New York City school teachers and people like them to be active in left-wing circles.
So was Meeropol a poet? Did he write poetry usually, or was this just something that was completely out of the blue?
No, he was an instinctive poet. He was always writing poems. He wrote hundreds or thousands of them. I mean, he was by profession a school teacher, but he was also an artist and a songwriter. And whenever he was moved to write a poem, he would. And this was one of those occasions where he was so indignant over seeing this photograph that he thought he should write something about it. And he wrote this sort of bitter, sardonic, sarcastic, indignant poem.
How different are the words of the poem to the lyrics of the song that people became so familiar with?
You know, as far as I can remember, I think they're identical. I don't think he changed them at all. I think only the title changed.
So how did it come about then that this poem, published in a fairly obscure journal, became a song? Who encouraged him to put it to music, and had he done that with his poems in the past?
I think that he had, you know, he was also a songwriter, and I think that he had set many of his poems to music. And I don't think he needed any particular encouragement to do it. I think that he recognized that he had something here that he wanted to further popularize. And it was just sort of an instinct for him to do it. And he was connected with various performers who put on shows, sort of politically saturated shows. And a group of singers who he was friendly with started to perform the song at union meetings and school teacher gatherings and things like this. And so the song started circulating very shortly after he wrote it. This would have been sometime in the mid-1930s. And the song became sort of a familiar anthem in these groups.
So one of the things about Strange Fruit, though, is how frank it is in the depiction of what's going on in the South. Other people may have written songs that weren't quite as upfront about what was going on as Strange Fruit. Or was it unusual? How unusual was Strange Fruit at the time to be so frank and honest about what was happening with lynchings?
Well, I think it was extraordinarily unusual. It was not the kind of thing that anybody set to music. There was really no precedent for this song at all. I mean, the only remote precedent was a song called Supper Time that Irving Berlin had written a few years earlier, in which the subject of lynching was referred to very, very elliptically. You know, it's a song sung by a black woman lamenting that her husband was never coming home again, and the implication was that he had been lynched. But the word lynching and black bodies and all of that, none of that is anywhere close to the song. It's only by implication that you can figure out what the song is about.
Mm-hmm.
So Strange Fruit was incredibly frank and blunt, and there had never been a song like it before. And really, I would say there's never been a song like it since. I mean, it was unique. It was really a slap in the face. There was no mistaking what it was about. It was unambiguous, and it was extremely blunt.
Do we know when it was first performed in public?
I think it would have been sometime in the mid to late 1930s, 1935, 36, 37, sometime around then.
And when then did it sort of move into the popular imagination? When did it become really well known?
Well, sometime around 1938, Mirapol brought the song to the man who owned Cafe Society, the sort of left-wing nightclub in Greenwich Village, on Sheridan Square in Greenwich Village. Billie Holiday was performing down there then, and Mirapol brought it to Barney Josephson, the owner of the club, with the idea that Billy would sing the song. And so he walked it down there and sat at the piano and sang the song for Barney Josephson and Billie Holiday. And it was only then, when Billie Holiday started to perform it at Cafe Society, that the song became more widely known.
Our guest is David Margalek, and he's the author of Strange Fruit, the biography of a song. So how big a star was Billie Holiday in the late 1930s?
Well, she was really quite a big star. She was particularly popular among jazz aficionados. She wasn't as huge a star as she was to become, but she was young and she was hip, and word about her was spreading very rapidly. She was already recording music, but she had never recorded anything remotely like this before. I mean, she had only sung sort of pop songs and jazz standards before this. She was not a particularly political figure.
Yeah. Did she have any history in the South? Would she have known people who may have had members of their families lynched, or maybe known people who themselves were lynched?
Well, you know, she was from Baltimore, and she had spent her childhood in Baltimore and Philadelphia. Baltimore is sort of on the fringes of the South.
Yeah.
I don't think that she had any direct encounter with people who had been lynched in the Deep South, which is where lynchings generally took place. But lynching was a very important part of the black consciousness, And even for people who weren't directly exposed to it, it was very much on their minds, and they all had associations with it. They all read about it in the black newspapers. It was very, very much on their minds, even for people who hadn't had direct encounters with it. There's nothing remote about it to them.
Why then did she record it? It's an extraordinary tune. It's very memorable, and the words are extremely memorable. But given that, even though she was a big star and she'd had these pop or jazz hits, and she'd never recorded anything like it, then surely it's taking a very big chance to record something like this.
It's a little bit ambiguous what Billie Holiday's original understanding of the song was. She didn't record it right away. In Barney Josephson's memoirs, it made it sound as if she really first started to sing the song, not out of any huge indignation herself, but really as a favor to him. That's how he recounted it. But as I said, it would have been an issue that would have been unfortunately very familiar to her. And obviously the song touched something in her. The song was not recorded immediately, and her normal label, which was Columbia, refused to record it for the usual reasons. They were afraid of offending Southern customers. And so she had to go to a very small, obscure record shop that also issued recordings to get the song recorded. It was recorded by a guy named Milt Gabler on Commodore Records. Milt Gabler is actually Billy Crystal's uncle.
Billy Crystal talks a lot about visiting his record store in New York and how that was really the center of jazz in New York City at the time.
Yes, that's right. And Billy Crystal, I think, also talks about having had Billie Holiday as a babysitter.
It's amazing.
A very improbable situation, really.
Yeah.
But it was recorded by Milt Gabler, and the song further developed as kind of a cult favorite. It was never, you know, a top 10 hit. It was really a song that was listened to by white radicals. It wasn't even particularly popular in the black community. And I guess for sort of obvious reasons, as the great jazz historian Albert Murray explained to me, you know, when we went out, we didn't want to hear people singing about lynching. And so this was not the kind of song that they necessarily danced to or played or enjoyed. It was really a song for white leftists, and they were the ones that popularized it.
Okay, so how then did she perform it in concert, whether it be in a club or in a theater? Must have been very difficult to do, given that it was extremely serious, nothing more serious as a subject of a song than this sort of thing. How did she perform it?
Well, it was very interesting that Strange Fruit and Billie Holiday's performances of Strange Fruit became a ritual at Cafe Society. It was advertised as the special part of her act. There was a little ad that ran, for instance, in the New Yorker that said, "Have you heard Billie Holiday sing Strange Fruit at Cafe Society?" It was something that people went to hear her sing. I mean, in a way that really is quite unimaginable for any other song. The singing of this particular song became a famous feature of her act. Feeling was that there was no way that you could follow up on a song like this. It had to end her set, and all the lights would go down, all the service would stop in Cafe Society. It would go dark, and there'd be a single light shining on her, and she would sing the song in her sort of quiet and plaintive way. And then the lights would go down again. When they came back on, she'd be gone. And there's a very interesting description in her book of the first time when she performed the song. And after it was done, people didn't know what to do. They had never heard a song like this before. And among other things, they didn't know whether to applaud. And there was this moment of silence until somebody started to clap, and then everybody joined in, but there was this great hesitancy because no one had ever heard a song like this before.
When did it start selling? Because it did sell at least a million copies at some stage.
Well, I think it was recorded around 1940 on the Commodore label, and then it started to sell. And as I said, it wasn't something that ever made the charts. It was generally sold in urban areas in the North, You know, it was big in New York. It would have been big in Philadelphia. It would have been big in northeastern cities and among sort of the left-wing college-educated crowd.
And then did she sing it for the rest of her life?
And she sang it for the rest of her life. And as I write in my book, the song sort of took on the coloration of her life. She sang it in a different kind of style than she first sang it in. The original, and you can trace the changes in the style of her singing in the various recordings that she made of it. The first recording is very cocky, jaunty, confident, kind of contemptuous. You know, there's the lyric about, you know, the pastoral scene of the gallant South, and there's a kind of contempt in her voice as she's singing about all of this. As her career went south and she faced all kinds of personal crises and arrests and drug problems and everything, the song took on a much sadder kind of tone. The later recordings are almost too painful to listen to. She performed it throughout her career. Again, it could only be performed in certain places, and really in nightclubs that were populated by politically congenial people. It wasn't the kind of thing that you could sing anywhere or that you could just take on the road. I don't think she ever sang it in the South. She had to be very, very careful about where she sang it, and inevitably there were people who were offended by it. The song never really lost its sting.
One of the hallmarks of a great song, though, is that how many people start covering that song. How soon after Billie Holiday recorded it and it was a hit and that she was singing it in concert, did other people start covering that song?
Well, the only person who originally covered the song was Josh White, the folk singer, the black folk singer, who also helped popularize it. And this sort of set up a confrontation between the two of them, because Holiday felt that it was really her song and that no one else should be doing it. I think that for many, many years after that, people were very reluctant to do the song because they felt that it really belonged to Billie Holiday, and to a degree that very few songs belong to any particular artist. And I think that they left it alone, and they were very reluctant to do it. It was really only in the later 50s and 60s and 70s that people started doing it. Nina Simone and other people like that started to do it. But I think that there was great deference shown to Holiday for many, many years. And apart from Josh White, people generally left the song to her.
And we're talking about Strange Fruit, and David Margalik is the author of the book about Strange Fruit, the biography of a song. The song was written by Abel Meeropol, and he had another extraordinary claim to fame. Just explain how it was that he came to adopt the children of two of the most controversial people in America in the 1950s.
Well, this is what originally interested me in the song and the story of the song, because it really ties together epic events in two different decades, in the 30s and the 50s. Of course, everybody will know that in 1953, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, the convicted atomic bomb spies, were executed, and they left two young sons. And these two boys needed a home. The Meeropols, Abel and Ann Meeropol, had never had any children. And through sort of left-wing circles in New York, this very appropriate marriage was made, and quietly the Meeropols adopted the two Rosenberg children. And gave them the greatest gift imaginable, which was a quiet, normal childhood. The two boys sort of disappeared. They took on the names of the Meeropols and were generally forgotten in a way that would really probably never happen today. And so it ties together, as I said, the sort of radical politics of the 1930s and the McCarthy era and the Red Scare of the 1950s.
It's 60 years, more than 60 years since the Rosenbergs were executed. It's hard now to understand how big a story that was. But how big was the story of the fact that these two people were convicted for giving American atomic bomb information to the Russians?
Well, it was an absolutely enormous story. It was at the height of the Cold War and the height of the McCarthy period and the height of paranoia about Soviet influence and the Soviet threat and it was the only time that a husband and wife have been executed on charges like this, and it was something that really that convulsed America. And so the execution of the Rosenbergs was really sort of the high watermark of Cold War paranoia.
Yeah.
And, you know, an absolutely cataclysmic event.
What happened to the two boys?
Well, the two boys, as I said, led sort of normal childhoods and were pretty much ignored and only emerged many years later as grown men calling for the reopening of their parents' case. They both became college professors. One really became a lawyer. The other became a college professor in New England. So they remained very politically active, Robbie and Michael Mirapol. But as I said, the Mirapols, the parents, Abel and Ann, gave them the greatest gift they could possibly have given them, which was a normal life. They were allowed to sort of blend back into society and develop their own personalities and go to college and emerge when they chose and in the way that they chose.
Did Abel Mirapol make a lot of money out of Strange Fruit?
I don't think he ever made a lot of money. I think that he made some. I think that Strange Fruit was a source of enormous satisfaction to him, but also a source of frustration because the song was habitually misattributed to other people, particularly to Billie Holiday, who sort of took credit either for writing the song or for having had the song written specifically for her. And so Mirapol was continually sort of staking his claim to the song and reminding people publicly and privately that it was his creation and his creation alone. He also wrote some other famous songs. He co-wrote The House I Live In, which many people will recognize. Frank Sinatra sang that. Mm. It won a special Academy Award in 1945, sort of an anthem to brotherhood coming out of World War II. And he continued to write. He continued to be active. He was a radical until the day he died.
And he died in the late 1980s. But 60-odd years after the song was written, Time magazine named it as the song of the 20th century. Do you think that's going too far, or do you think that's appropriate?
Well, I have to say that I was a little bit surprised when that happened. I mean, I think it happened. I don't mean to be immodest, but I think it happened as a result of my book, which came out around the same time that Time did that. You know, one could say that White Christmas was the song of the 20th century. It was a lot more popular than Strange Fruit. But in its articulation of racial tensions, the racial blot on the 20th century and the whole element of intolerance, I don't think there was a song that better captured the intolerance of the 20th century than Strange Fruit. And so in that sense, even though it didn't sell millions of copies, it touched millions of people. There are all kinds of people who heard the song as kids and never forgot it, and whose own racial consciousness and radicalism and progressivism was ignited by the song. And in that sense, you know, maybe it is a legitimate claim. I mean, there are many contenders to that, you know, to that position of the song of the 20th century. It was sort of an imaginative leap for Time magazine to do that. But as I said, in the themes that it articulated, it peculiarly captures the intolerance of the 20th century and the need for amelioration, the need to confront these issues. And there was never a song that did it as bluntly as Strange Fruit did.
And I think that is the triumph of the song, is that the lyrics are there. You just have to listen to them to understand what the singer is talking about, that you don't have to think, well, hang on, what do they really mean? It's there, and by listening to the song, it forces you to confront that issue.
I think that's right. And even though lynching, you know, has largely disappeared, but for horrific examples that arise from time to time, the sort of intolerance that Strange Fruit illustrates obviously remains very, very much with us. And so even though literally it's not quite as applicable as it once was, certainly metaphorically it's every bit as appropriate and every bit as important and really every bit as powerful. I don't think there's any other song that has the capacity to shock and sensitize still after all these decades in the way that Strange Fruit does.
And that's why we're still talking about it today. David, thank you very much for talking to us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
David Margalek, the author of Strange Fruit, the biography of a song.